Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with 4 Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Hey, Trey Kay here, and from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them, the show that tells the stories about the things that divide us. This is a year of racial reckoning. It's a time when black and brown people continue to die at the hands of police. There are challenges for us, to say the names of victims, to create consequences for police brutality, to acknowledge and address white privilege, to defy injustice. It's that atmosphere that greets a new podcast, Sounds Like Hate. It's supported by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I recently talked with one of its hosts. A warning here. Some of the conversation and excerpts talk about graphic violence, and listeners could find it offensive.
Hi, so my name is Geraldine Moriba, and I'm a journalist, but I also spend a lot of time figuring out how to make us better journalists, and then I also do equity training in newsrooms, so I wear several hats, but ultimately, I'm a journalist.
What drew you to this subject?
First of all, I'm female. I am an immigrant. I am black. My parents were immigrants. There are lots of reasons that I should feel marginalized. And I have many cultures within my background, but I'm also American, very American. I've been in this country for 3 decades. But what I was going to say is what motivates me is I have throughout my career found myself in a space of trying to figure out the motivation and denial of hate. And I think for this documentary series, this audio documentary series, it's at the heart of people who become extremists. Like, why do they commit these acts of hate? And why do some of them change?
I mean, the thing that I really appreciated about this is that it seems as though when a lot of people do this investigative work into racial extremism, it almost seems like, well, that the big reveal is to call them out, coax them out of whatever, you know, hole they may be living in, and publicly... make everybody aware. This is who you are. This is what you do. And it seems like your work is more than that.
It's really important to explore the darkest aspects of society. But equally, it's important to understand that there's goodness in people and we're human. So, you know, this is just an effort to push and pull at stereotypes and firmly held beliefs and stir people as they're listening. But also, there are going to be people listening who are in this space, and we want them to know there's a way out.
So this has been your beat for a long time, your journalism beat, no?
So no, this isn't my beat per se, but it's a story I come back to again and again because I feel compelled to.
And when you say that this is important, especially now, why is that?
What's new is how bold people are becoming with these expressions of extremism, how radicalized people are becoming openly and feeling comfortable to express themselves this way. And there are two ways to look at that. There's a school that says, okay, this is new and we have to tackle it and it's a problem. And then there's a school that says it's already been there. It's always been there. And now it's easier to address because it's visible. You can document it, count it, and deal with it.
So for our episode today, we wanted to focus on the initial episode of your podcast, Sounds Like Hate, which is put out with the support of the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in the first two episodes that you call Getting Out, it focuses on a woman who was deeply involved in a race extremist organization. And before you introduce us to her, you take us back to Charlottesville. That was the Unite the Right rally where there were guys carrying tiki torches demonstrating around a statue of Robert E. Lee. And of course, there's the tragedy of Heather Heyer being mowed down and killed by a white supremacist who was in a speeding car who just ramrodded into a crowd. And it's in the days following that event when we first get to hear from Samantha, and she's a leader of an alt-right extremist group called Identity Europa. Now, what is this organization?
Identity Europa is a white supremacist group. It's a part of the white power tradition, and it's connected to the history of this push for white power in America. It connects directly to the KKK and to other extremist organizations. What makes this group different is they're trying to do it with a suit and a tie. They change their language. They're not overtly using racist language and words. They are clean cut. They're not using the typical paraphernalia that extremists use of, you know, symbols on their arms, numbers and symbols and things that send coded messages. Instead, they're trying to seem very, very mainstream and normal. But in actuality, what they're promoting is a separate white ethnostate.
Early in your podcast, there's this meeting that we hear. It is the woman that we're following. Her name is Samantha, and she is having a meeting with a journalist. Can you tell us how this meeting came to pass?
She was organizing in the way that women do. She was finding female recruits to support, to provide transportation, to get food, to make sure the men had water, that there was going to be a place for them to go to and party after the rally, to make sure there was liquor in those places, and also to communicate their goals, to spread the word and help in all of the ways that they needed to organize this event. And Samantha was the head of the women's division of Identity Europa. And basically what happened was Richard Spencer, who himself is a known racist and the head of his own organization, reached out to Samantha. Well, he was contacted by Glenna Gordon about doing an interview, and Glenna was doing a series about women in these extremist white power groups. So he asked Samantha to participate, and it was intended to be a test. This was Richard Spencer's way of seeing how well Samantha could perform under these circumstances. What he didn't realize was Samantha was at that moment beginning to have second thoughts about her role in this group and what she was contributing to. So when she met Glenna, it was the beginning of a change for Samantha.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of this clip.
Thank you. Do you need cream and sugar?
Some milk would be great.
Okay. Sitting in a cafe, Samantha did her best to convey the talking points of the alt-right.
You have these kids that went to this rally and all they wanted to do was demonstrate peacefully, and literally the entire world is blaming them for murder, for racism, for all of these things that have been going on long before these people were alive.
But that doesn't change the fact that the person who did kill somebody came from a far-right group.
I think that until all of that has been proven, until this trial is done, it's not fair to speculate. We don't know what was going on in their mind.
James Fields is the white supremacist Samantha's talking about here. He's the man who drove his car into a crowd, killing Heather Heyer. He was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Back then, 2 days after the rally, Samantha defended him.
I don't know if anyone could really put themselves in his shoes and say, if I were at a dangerous rally and I had adrenaline rushing and all this stuff, I would have known at that moment to do something differently. Like, I don't think it's...
I mean, there were maybe 1,000 people there who didn't make a difference.
It happens. Life happens.
We're listening to a clip from the podcast from the Southern Poverty Law Center that's called Sounds Like Hate. And I'm speaking to one of the hosts and producers of that show, Geraldine Mariba. So Glenna Gordon, the reporter, is speaking to Samantha in this cafe. And Samantha is basically saying, you know, let's don't be so quick to judge the guy who killed Heather Heyer. And then Gordon says there were thousands of people who made a different choice that day. And Samantha's response was, it happens. Life happens. I mean, wow. That sounds so detached, so matter of fact, so just another bump in the road.
I think first I have to point out to everybody listening that Samantha no longer feels that way. I don't want anyone to walk away thinking that she's still that person. But at that moment, Samantha was that person. At that moment, Samantha believed the misinformation, the lies she was being fed, and fell into this twisted world that where there are white people who feel as though they are victims. And she really dug in. And if you listen to the entire exchange that we heard that was recorded of their entire conversation, this is just a small sample. Samantha really, at that moment in her life, thought that the killing of Heather Heyer was justified. She thought that it was just a small step in a larger war. And she was convinced that this killing by James Fields was justified. So that's what she's expressing. And she's expressing it with her full conviction.
Just out of curiosity, why is it that in the piece we only hear from Samantha by her first name? We don't know her last name.
Samantha is still in hiding, and she may be for the rest of her life. She made a terrible mistake. It's a mistake that means there will always be the possibility that somebody wants to harm her. So she's being cautious. She's not sharing her last name. She still changes the way she looks periodically. She still moves from place to place. And I hope now that I've come to know her, I do hope that there's a point where she finds normalcy and she can settle down and continue with her life in a way that's not shaped by fear. But right now, she's still living in fear.
How did Samantha get involved with Identity Europa?
Because she was dating somebody who found himself going down this road towards extremism. And she was trying to get his attention. She felt like her competition was this white nationalist group he had joined. So to get him back on board and to notice her, she decided to explore it and see what it is that was getting all of his attention. And within a couple of days, she was hooked. She started exchanging emails with people. They were answering her questions, you know, feeding her lies. And she just accepted it. She put away her beliefs and just accepted what they were telling her. And it was that easy. And that's what makes this so scary. It didn't take years of indoctrination. It was over a Christmas holiday. And in a couple of days, she was sold just like that.
So she becomes very involved in this Identity or Europa organization. And you say that she feels a sense of belonging and connection. So what role does she play in the organization?
Oh, Samantha was, what's fascinating is not only did she join and get hooked quickly, she climbed up the ladder quickly. Like in a matter of weeks, she was appointed to the role of women's coordinator. And that role is actually quite important. It meant that she was responsible for recruiting women into this organization. And remember, while men are front-facing and they're the ones we see getting arrested, they're the ones we see marching, there would be no white supremacist organization anywhere if women weren't there supporting them too. Like these men do not act alone. They're supported by women who wholeheartedly give their support.
Let's hear a little bit more from the podcast, Sounds Like Hate.
A warning to our listeners, some of the content you're about to hear is graphic and sexually violent.
The way that women were roped in, and then once they were in, the way they immediately lost their agency and power and sense of self and self-worth. I went through a lot of psychological abuse and a lot of gaslighting. You couldn't go to any parties unless you had a boyfriend or unless you were associated to a specific man in there. And in order to do that, you had to date someone in there. And when you dated a man in there, whatever he said went. And a lot of the men in there were very controlling, would only let you go to certain parties, would stalk you if you rejected them. I can't tell you how many women would tell me that they went on a date or two with some guy and he either proposed to her by the second date or demanded physical intimacy. She wasn't ready for it, didn't know how to say no. He then said that she was a whore, that she was worthless, that he, you know, that she was bad breeding stock anyway, that he would find her and kill her, that he would find her family and tell them how despicable of a person she was. And this is more than one woman. It was just this common occurrence.
Is that something that you witnessed?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw it. I mean, I never watched a woman get raped, but I know that they were. I know that they were. You don't forget calls like that. You don't forget tones of voice like that. You don't forget the sound of a woman trying to understand why something just happened and if it was her fault for saying no. You know, a lot of women's value as they got deeper into the movement was solely based on their physical attraction and like sexual value. A lot of men would joke about gang raping women and then to get calls from women or messages from women saying that they were raped or abused. And then you go to another party where you hear those jokes again, you start to realize that they're not jokes. They're almost bragging or making plans.
Geraldine, I'm really surprised to be talking about gender roles within a white power organization.
The premise of groups like this is based on this idea of propagating the white race, of building their numbers. So women are seen as these vehicles to have white babies, which is the foundation of abuse. They're not seen as equal partners. It's not a sense of love. They're put on a pedestal because they're seen as these machines that make babies. So consequently, women are abused, and she witnessed it again and again. And to protect the identity of the victims, she was very careful about what she shared about herself and other women.
Do you think that the way that she saw how these women were treated within the group was a turning point for at least sowed the seeds for her eventually wanting to leave?
not only did that sow these doubts and these questions in her mind, but after leaving, she's now trying to help women who are still on the inside. I mean, that's become her mission, to try to help these women realize they're not doing a good thing. The ideology is harmful to these women and the men in their lives and society as a whole. The notion is that if white women don't have at least three children, they're speeding their race to extinction. And that reproductive capacity is the foundation of white power ideology. That's what draws men to this movement. It's what draws women to this movement. It somehow gives them an identity that they can wrap themselves around and hold on to.
I'm talking with Geraldine Mareeba, one of the hosts of the new podcast Sounds Like Hate from the Southern Poverty Law Center. After a break, we'll continue with the story of Samantha as she begins to question her connection to the white power group Identity Europa.
So I just started to think critically about the movement and realized, like, none of this actually makes sense. This actually is just productive racism. This actually is just gearing up for a bunch of angry, insecure white people to commit violence.
I'm Trey Kay, and you're listening to Us and Them. This program is supported by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
Hey, it's Trey, and this is Us and Them from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX. Geraldine Mareeba is one of the hosts of the new podcast called Sounds Like Hate. It's supported by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and it looks at some of the underpinnings of the current generation of racial hatred in this country. In one of the first episodes, we meet a young woman named Samantha and learn about her work with a white power group called Identity Europa. Mareeba says it's important to understand that the people who belong to racist groups come from all backgrounds.
They are highly, highly educated with PhDs, and they are also high school dropouts. They are extremely wealthy, like people who can fund foundations, and they are also homeless. They're both people who have influential jobs, who work in government and politics, and people who might be packing your grocery bag at your local supermarket. I mean, the members of these groups come in all shapes and sizes, and they are, a lot of them, highly, again, informed, and it's not as though they lack some type of critical thinking. That's not a part of this equation. Samantha is extremely intelligent. Listening to her, you realize that. She's analytical. She asks questions. She challenges. She's a thinking adult. And still, even Samantha got sucked in, because it happens.
So eventually, Samantha started having doubts. And I recall you asking her about that in your report. Let's listen to that right now.
When did you start questioning your loyalty to Identity Europa?
So I just started to think critically about the movement and realized, like, none of this actually makes sense. This actually is just productive racism. This actually is just gearing up for a bunch of angry, insecure white people to commit violence. And I'm sure a lot of people in there, when they joined, didn't think that.
But you helped recruit.
Yeah.
You were actively involved.
Exactly. And that's, I feel like that almost made it even more difficult because there was still a part of me that was true in that movement that I didn't use racial slurs, but I was still racist. I was still, you know, this garbage person with this dumpster fire of a mind. I don't come from a white, straight Christian background, or at least not a fully white, straight Christian background. So it was really hard to realize that I had compromised myself and everything that I knew to be true.
What does that mean? I don't come from a white, straight Christian background.
I mean, I have people in my family, you know, my brother's gay, my aunts and uncles are gay, I have people in my family that are Muslim from Iran, you know, or Iranian Americans. I have Jewish people in my family, and I love them all.
But Samantha's diverse family background didn't stop her from becoming a white nationalist. Instead of being appalled, she was charmed. She attended book burnings, and sometimes she raised her hand in a Nazi Sieg Heil salute.
You're at a party, someone starts to do it, and you almost, it just felt like, you know, the whole crowd joins in, and whoever doesn't is a chicken.
If you don't do it.
Yeah. I mean, there were jokes amongst leaders that they don't trust people that don't see Kyle. Because either you don't understand the irony, quote unquote, or because you just don't believe in what they believe.
Photojournalist Gordon says white supremacist groups put men in front-facing positions and women in support functions.
Even if women are doing, for example, all the labor of organizing who's in which car to get to Charlottesville. Like, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of labor. To unpack white supremacy, you have to look at how they're contributing. Why is it important that there's a picnic before the cross burning? Women create the space for those public events, for the men to do the more outward-looking jobs. And I think that in the same way that women's work is overlooked across the board, we overlook it when we look at white supremacy. Then we're like, we have to deal with all these disenfranchised young men. And you're like, cool. And the women who make sure that they have a picnic to go to.
Wait a second. We're describing a woman's worth in white supremacy. Yeah. Like the picnic.
Yeah.
Planning this march.
Yeah.
Getting the cars to bring the guys to Charlottesville to beat people.
Yeah, that's women's work. And that's why I think it's important that we look at the fact that they do it. If we are only addressing public violence, we are not addressing white supremacy. White supremacy is also that picnic. That's the whole point. When we look at this like tip of the iceberg, the people out there beating each other with clubs, like that is such a small percentage of the damage that white supremacy does. Also, so many things go into that one act of public violence. So many hateful picnics.
So many hateful picnics. One of the other things that I found so fascinating about your report is about Samantha's connection with her family. And it's very interesting to hear how they lived through this. I mean, we heard her earlier say that she had Muslims and Jewish family members and some who are gay. And there's this compelling part of your report where you speak to Samantha's brother about his feelings of his sister's involvement with a white extremist group. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
How did this information become revealed to you?
That
Do you
she
remember?
Was practicing white supremacy? I mean, like the entire time it's been, I was privy to it. Like she basically served it to me on a silver platter and was like, this is what I'm doing. But I didn't really piece it together until those extreme instances were brought up and I had to like seriously consider breaking my relationship with her.
You did?
Oh, absolutely.
And what prevented you from doing that?
I really don't know. I mean, she's my sister and I love her and we've grown so close together.
You're openly gay.
Who told you?
How did you feel about your sister's involvement with people who were adamantly anti-LGBTQ?
She always, like, reassured me. Like, oh, don't worry. It's okay. Like, just don't flaunt it.
How's that reassuring?
She's telling you to hide it.
Well, yeah. No, exactly. That's the point. Like, it was... She would try to convince me that her ideology and everything that she was with at the time was the right thing to do and was the future of the United States and the world.
I would like to think that not only would Samantha's brother be disturbed by his sister's racist ideology, but that the people around her in this organization could potentially do him harm and maybe harm to other family members. Was this a concern to Samantha's brother?
You know, what's fascinating about Samantha and her brother is, in a twisted way, she had convinced herself she could protect him as an individual. So she was not at all denying that anybody who was gay was not in danger by this organization she was a part of. She didn't deny that. She just thought, they'll make an exception of him because he's my brother, which was the point I was trying to make to him when I asked him whether or not she was opposed to him and how he felt about that. And, you know, likewise, it gave him a small sense of safety too. So it's all complicated. And I will say, meeting her brother twice, he came when we met the first time, and then he came to the interview and participated. He is a really special human being who deeply loves his sister. He really wants her to be well. He wants her to do the right thing. And he's 100% behind her, supporting her. It was very moving to see them together, and deeply disturbing to know that he was trying to support her, even though he knew that supporting her as a human being meant potentially victimizing himself.
Supporting her, what could have caused harm to him, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's interesting that we hear from him. Have other family members been less kind and less understanding?
Samantha was quite open with her family throughout her entire experience, and not just because she was saying, hey, guess what group I joined? She was open because she was trying to bring them over. She was trying to bring her brother over. She was trying to bring her mother over. At the same time, they were all pushing back and saying, what's wrong with you? Why are you doing this? What's going on? And there was this push and pull between them. When Samantha decided to go into hiding and disguise herself and just disappear, she told her mother that she was leaving and that she wouldn't hear from her for a long time. And if she's lucky, she'll get out and they'll reconnect. But there's a possibility that once she leaves, her life's in danger and that might be their last conversation. Can you imagine having that conversation with your mother?
It just sounds horrible.
It's horrible. The entire notion of killing other people, harming other people because of skin color, because of religious beliefs, because of sexual orientation, is absolutely wrong. There's no other way to define it.
So eventually, Samantha chose to disconnect from Identity Europa. What was that process like?
So the process of getting out of any organization like this is not straightforward. It's not only about disassociating with the people you knew, it's also about deconstructing your thoughts. So Samantha not only had to physically move to a place where she couldn't and wouldn't interact with them anymore, and that meant not just a physical space, but a digital space. So she had to eliminate all of her accounts online and shut them down and move away to another location. But she also had to start the process of reevaluating what she believed and her values and start to associate with people she wanted to be more like, and making smarter decisions about who she spent time with, and getting counseling, quite frankly, because knowing what she was a part of and finally acknowledging that, that takes not only courage, but it takes this honest amount of acknowledgement that you did something terribly wrong, that you did something that was so wrong it cost someone their life. And she was a part of that. No, she did not drive the car. She did not put her foot on the accelerator, but she helped organize the situation that made that killing possible.
What do you hope to accomplish with this Sounds Like Hate series?
I hope that Sounds Like Hate helps us as a nation get beyond these divides. I hope that it helps us think about our fragilities. It helps us think about our firmly held beliefs, to question ourselves. I mean, ultimately, our goal with this podcast is to stir people, to ask them, have them ask themselves why they believe what they believe, and start to act, start to do things that help us build bridges, not separate us. And I know that sounds sort of Pollyanna-ish, but the reality is we are at a crossroads as a nation. And unless we start to challenge some of these beliefs, and if everybody does something, if each person does one socially beneficial thing, it really makes a difference.
Geraldine Mareeba, you have a really powerful series, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more of it. Great work, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share the story.
I'm really moved by Samantha's story. Inspired by it, actually. It shows me that a person heavily indoctrinated and invested in a mindset of hate can hear a voice deep within them that says, this doesn't feel right, and then have the courage to change course. I agree with Geraldine Mareeba. Our nation is at a crossroads. We need conversations with those across the divide to understand this moment more clearly. And maybe the first step in closing that divide is for each of us to consider the role we play in this division. No, most of us are not in racial extremist groups. We were not screaming at people who don't believe as we do. But is it enough to call out these racial extremists? To revile them for what they believe? Have we taken the time to think about our role in the racial tension in our nation? And ultimately, once we do that work, what about the next step? If someone who was once filled with hate chooses to walk away and follow a new path, can we embrace them? Can we forgive their blatant racist past? You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay, Kyle Vass, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to Elizabeth Johnson and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Lilena Price provides us with images for the web. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and the CRC Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on us and them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.